Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of June 6, 2016. But we saved all that money not paying for tax advice. Current federal tax developments is brought to you by all of the state societies of CPAs across the U.S. and Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to be presenting this week some of the developments we've had here in the area of federal taxes. We're going to take a look at a couple of situations that cried out for having a tax advisor involved and end up with some bad results because an advisor wasn't involved, or at least anybody who actually knew how federal taxes work wasn't involved in the transaction. Specifically this week, we're going to look at the following five different major developments. We'll first look at a memo that talks about how paying employees to participate in your wellness program may be fine, but it may also be taxable. We'll take a look how the IRS ruled about an estate settlement and the tax consequences that the parties to the settlement probably didn't intend, but which the IRS will point out are going to happen. We also find a taxpayer who manages to arrange his affairs in such a way that he pays tax twice on the same income and doesn't have any recourse to get out of it because he missed his chance to claim a deduction. We also take a look at a sanctioned tax preparer who the IRS could not succeed in using what he did for tax returns for his clients to prove that his own personal return had understatements of tax represented a fraudulent return. And finally, we'll take a look at the IRS, which gives us a ruling regarding when an LLC makes its initial entity selection and that initial entity selection can actually be years after we form the LLC. We'll discuss why in the world is it important if it's an initial selection or not. Well, basically, hey, we're in summer here in Phoenix, and I'm here in Phoenix, and our high today is going to be somewhere around 114, so we have nice, bright, clear, sunny skies, but it's rather hot. The pictures always look good. The actual experience, not so wonderful, especially if you're in a car that's been sitting in the sun for a while. But nevertheless, it also means we're past the tax season. Officially, of course, we're still in spring, though don't tell that to anybody here in Phoenix. But since we're past tax season, it's time to start looking at your continuing education, and all the state societies have their catalogs out and available now. So you want to go ahead, take a look, make sure you take a look at what's available. I'm going to be doing a few courses here in Arizona, coming up here in what I'll refer to as my Interstate 10 tour. That is, I'm going to be doing a couple of courses. We're going to be doing them both in Phoenix and Tucson. In Phoenix, on June 13th, I'll do an 8-hour course on investment taxation and Medicare tax and beyond. That'll be both in Phoenix and available as a webcast here in Arizona. I'll do the 4-hour Arizona ethics course and then a 4-hour Arizona income tax update and overview on June 14th, so you can take one or both of those. And finally, I'll go down to Tucson and have the course on advanced issues dealing with pass-through entities. Significantly there, we're going to spend time talking there about the new partnership exam rules, which are going to be a pain. So that's going to be a useful one down in Tucson at the Viscount Suite. So I hope to see you at one of those if you're here in Arizona. I'll be traveling out to other parts of the country later, but in June, I stay here in Arizona. Sometimes I believe largely because nobody else would want to come here in June. May or may not be the reason, but we'll take a look at it. Let's move on to our first case here, or actually our first chief counsel advice. And this is a chief counsel advice that talked about a program that was a wellness program. And this particular chief counsel advice that was issued to an agent asked the question about whether or not these incentive payments or incentive awards being made to employees should or should not be considered taxable to the employee and subject to payroll taxes. The memo, in fact, looks at three different wellness programs and tries to determine if they should or should not be included in income. It actually determines that all three of them should. In the first situation, the employer provides all employees, regardless of their enrollment in anything else, participation in the wellness program. Now, if they meet certain requirements, the employer will, as an incentive to those employees, give them cash awards of varying amounts or give them something like a gym membership, none of which are medical expenses under 213D. The IRS rules in this case that, A, when an employer gives an employee a benefit that is not specifically excluded by the code and paying for medical expenses, while that's okay if it's a non-discriminatory program, is excludable, this wellness program extra money, sorry guys, you pay tax on that. Then we take a look at a couple of other programs here. In the second situation, we provide all employees, regardless of their enrollment and other coverage, certain benefits under a wellness program. Those who elect to participate in a wellness program pay a required fee. So now the employees pay to participate. Can we give them money back? Well, in this case, the same ruling comes down. If the employer gives them something, let's say a gym membership or cash, both of those are going to be considered to be a payment to the employee. The third case looked at the issue of an employee of a program where we had a 125 plan. And not surprisingly, if it was being paid with after-tax dollars and the payments coming back were going to be considered to be taxable income, you'd probably bet that under a 125 plan, the same problem is going to be considered a taxable payment, which it was. Now, all of this goes because the employer was trying to differentiate this from a ruling that came out a number of years ago. That was Revenue Ruling 2002-3. Revenue Ruling 2002-3 provided where an employer had refunded part of the insurance premiums in certain cases. And the ruling in that case in 2002-3 was refunding the insurance premium was considered a taxable event. So if you're paying them back because they met certain goals, they did certain things to help you maybe with underwriting, that wasn't going to help you there. You're going to end up with taxable. This ruling says basically all of these are considered taxable under this provision. Next up, we have another case coming down, another issue coming down here. This takes a look at Private Letter Ruling 2016-23001. This particular ruling is an unfortunate case of a situation where we got into some confusion about the interaction of community property laws, the federal tax law, and IRAs. In this case, in Private Letter Ruling 2016-23001, issued on June 3rd, we have a husband and wife and a child who was their child. They got married in 2004. Obviously, following that, the husband dies at some point here. The husband had left all three IRAs to the child. Now, most likely, you're going to assume that there was some issue here. Probably, it may have been simply that they hadn't actually planned. The husband may have died in an accident suddenly, in essence, unexpectedly. They'd left everything to the kid because that's what we wanted to do. But it turns out when the husband dies, when he's much younger than they had expected it was going to happen, you know, then they said, well, no, this doesn't work. Wife needs money. So the surviving spouse filed suit against the estate for her community property share of the assets. Presumably, now you might say, wait, she's filing suit against her own child. Well, basically, you know, the child's going to be appointed representative. You've got to watch this because as a parent, you have the problem that you have to be a fiduciary duty to the child in this case. So generally, we're going to end up with somebody else appointed. Attorneys will talk to you about how that would work in this situation. But we're probably going to have to go to court, have a lawsuit, have somebody represent the child, and then we got a settlement. Now, the agreement that was approved by the state court ordered one half of the IRAs to be changed over and transferred to the surviving spouse, and the court ordered the custodian to treat them as spousal rollover IRAs. Now, here's our problem. The big problem we have here is, as noted on the slide, the IRS notes this option is not available because Section 408G of the code provides very simply, community property rules are not to be considered for purposes of IRAs. Therefore, even though it's still a community property asset, and this gets very confusing, and by the way, CPAs, if you're not an attorney, do not try to interpret these rules, but get legal counsel to figure out what it is. But generally, it's community property. The state law will give credit to that as community property, but federally, it was still all the decedent's, and the decedent's allocation of it to the child had to be respected. The anti-alienation rules also come into play. So when the child tries to assign that interest, or when the court assigns that interest to the mother, that's considered to be a distribution, this is where it gets bad, to the child. And mom can't put that in an IRA because it's not an inherited IRA for mom. So double bad effect. We pay current tax on all the money that's being transferred to mom, and mom can't put it in an IRA account. This is unfortunately one of those situations that often occurs when people try to act outside of their expertise, is where we see this happen quite often. That is, you have somebody and a problem. Here the problem was, you know, trying to deal with assets, so it's an estate probate type problem. But you had somebody, probably counseling the parties in this case, who wasn't really a tax expert and just assumed that they could solve this problem by the agreement in the parties. Now, you might say, wait a minute, the court ordered the custodian to treat this as a spousal IRA. That's all fine and good, but in this situation, the court's order is about as important as me walking up and telling Chase Bank what their policies should be. Reality is, I have no standing to do so. The reality is, the state court has no standing to write federal law. Since the state court didn't have the right to do this, there's no way to get there. This is a really, really bad result. We can probably agree on that. More importantly, though, I suspect what may have happened here was, because the private letter ruling never really says that the transfer took place, just that the order was issued, I suspect that everything was running just fine until they went to the custodian, who said, I'm not sure you can do this, and balked at doing it without a private letter ruling. So we went and got one, and now we got one, and now we've got a problem. Well, this is the only case where we had an issue this week with an with somebody not really, you know, paying attention to the tax law or getting a result that didn't seem to be in line with what you might have expected. In Udabong versus Commissioner, and I'm certain I'm pronouncing this person's name wrong, and I apologize for that, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-109 issued on June 2nd. This is a case where a taxpayer managed to pay tax twice on the same income. In this particular case, the taxpayer was a provider who was being paid by Cigna for Medicaid reimbursement. Cigna was apparently, you know, running the Medicaid program in the state in question, and it was handling the payouts. Eventually, Cigna decided that this gentleman, and he received these payments through 2005, decided that in fact he wasn't eligible to receive those payments and demanded repayment. This gentleman repaid those funds because, quite honestly, under these programs, there's not a whole lot of options. It's take the money and then we'll fight about it later. So he repays the money. Now, here's where the problem comes. Through 2005, he had reported these sums as income. When he pays them back, he doesn't report this as a deduction, nor does he claim a credit under the claim of right rules. Now, that's kind of a problem for him because, basically, under the claim of right rules, and these are discussed in Section 1341A of the Code, he would have been eligible to either a current deduction in the year in which he paid it back, or potentially, since it was a claim of right issue, he could have gone back, recomputed his tax for the years he included the funds, and claimed a tax credit. But he did neither that year. He didn't do that because he filed suit against Cigna. Remember, you pay them back, then you sue them to get the money back. So he went to court, sued, you know, raised in suit. He eventually wins the case. So, hey, great news. Now the problem comes. Even though he won the case, he gets the money back. Cigna issues a 1099, including these payments. He doesn't include these payments on his tax return because he says, wait a minute, that wasn't really income. I've already paid tax on this amount. And therefore, you know, I shouldn't have to pay tax on it again. That makes perfect sense from a, you know, general, let's say, practical approach. Seems like it would make sense. Seems like it'd be the proper result. Problem is, under the tax law, it's not. Rather, because the claim of right rule kicked in, when he paid it back, he had to claim the repayments as a deduction at that point. He then files the lawsuit. The lawsuit then gets him paid that money back again. That restores it to him, picks it up as income. The way this works, he had to have claimed that deduction in the year in which he paid it back. The fact that he didn't does not give him the right to exclude it from income when he actually pays it, when he actually receives it. What happens is he absolutely had to report that as a deduction when he paid it back. Failing to do so, tough luck, he ends up with a double taxation on the same income. Nasty result, big problem. Next, let's take a look at the case of Erickson versus Commissioner. This case, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-107. This is where the IRS failed in their attempt to apply the 75% fraud penalty against a tax preparer for the tax preparer's own return when the tax preparer had an understatement of tax. Now, this was a preparer, kind of interestingly enough, who for which the IRS had received a number of complaints about the preparer's work. A number of other preparers had said, you know, this guy is really doing lousy work. He, you know, we look at his returns and it looks like there's always a totally fake, bogus Schedule C. And there seem to be these employee business expenses that pop up that don't have any basis in reality. You know, we're filing. So people file complaints when they get returns this guy had done before. They said, this is the problem. IRS, you need to do something about this guy. The IRS actually did do something about this guy. In fact, in reality, the IRS managed to get an injunction that basically prevented him from being a paid tax preparer in the future based on his work. They presented evidence in a district court case, so he's shut down. Now, not surprisingly, the IRS, looking at the returns of his clients, they looked at his returns. Also not surprisingly, the IRS found that as he had had his clients underpay tax, he underpaid his tax. So the IRS says, you know what? This is fraud. And we think we should be able to charge the fraud penalty. The fraud penalty, remember, is 75% of the understatement attributable to fraud. And if the understatement's attributable to fraud, there is no statute of limitations. So the IRS said, you know what? We saw what he did. We've gone to district court. We've won an injunction against this guy. He was fraudulent. Therefore, his return itself should be fraudulent. And therefore, since his return's fraudulent, we should be able to get the 75% penalty. The problem was the evidence the IRS presented in tax court. The IRS agent involved claimed he saw a pattern of fraud where there was what was mentioned before. There would be a bogus Schedule C, and there would be some overstated employee business expenses. The problem is the evidence of that he presented in court was only from two of the taxpayer's clients, and only one of those two returns had that bogus Schedule C and the employee business expenses that weren't real. The other return, while it had an understatement, did not have either of those problems. So the court said, look, you know, you claim there's a pattern. We don't see a pattern from the evidence you've given us. The court did make it very clear they were aware of the district court case in a footnote and noted that at the district court case, it appears the IRS presented a much more complete case on the nature of what this gentleman did, but the court was not going to accept that if the IRS didn't present the evidence in this case. The IRS also had a problem here. The court said, even if we had accepted that, the other problem we have with your show of fraud is the Mr. Erickson's own personal return did not have either of those two items. He was really bad records. In fact, they disallowed deductions because he had no adequate records. They didn't necessarily believe his statement that the computer had crashed, and that's why his records were missing, since they noticed he never said that until we got to tax court. But the court said, nevertheless, the IRS, who has the burden of showing fraud in this case, could not show a pattern of fraud. And they, you know, the IRS's statement was what he did for the clients was the absolute best evidence that he was fraudulently trying to get out of his own personal taxes. The court said, well, that's not good evidence at all. Secondly, the IRS said, well, anyway, he's a 20-year paid professional. You know, he's a tax expert. Therefore, he should be held to a higher standard. In this case, the court kind of said, well, Mr. Erickson may have been in taxes for 20 years. He may have a master's degree. He may have worked for a certified public accountant. But frankly, it doesn't appear he learned a whole lot. He has a lot of total from his testimony in the court. He had a lot of just basic misunderstandings of how the tax law worked. Being misunderstandings may be incompetence, may be negligence, but it's not fraud. And they're saying you failed to show you met the burden to show fraud. They still applied the 20% accuracy related penalty against this gentleman. That was no problem, but they did not apply the 75% fraud penalty, and they didn't treat two other earlier years the IRS wanted to assess tax and penalty against as being open for either in this case, because the court said, sorry, IRS, you have failed to carry your burden of showing that this was actually a fraudulent return. Without the fraudulent return, we don't have any way, you know, in essence, those cases, those years don't open up, and the penalty doesn't open up. let's get on to our final case of the week. And this is actually another private letter ruling, private letter ruling 2016-22020, issued on May the 27th. In this case, a limited liability company was formed, and it was one of those things where you go out and you form it, but you don't really get around to doing anything with it. So it had no assets, no activities. It sat there as a shell for some period of time. Eventually, they decided they were going to start using this thing as a real entity. And so they're going to put assets in it, and they want to have this thing treated as a corporation. The question became, is this their initial election? And the problem with that is the IRS ruled in this case, they said, well, since the entity really didn't do anything and had no activity, even though it may have been in existence for years, this is actually its initial election. So this counts not as a change of status, but as your initial choice of the status of what type of entity this thing will be. That's important because generally under the regulations for check the box, you cannot have a change in status in less than 60 months after you've changed your status before unless you get the IRS's permission. But that 60-month rule does not apply to the initial election. Thus, since this would be the entity's initial election, they could go ahead and if they want to down the line, it won't be tax-free, but they could treat it as to go away from a corporation and shift back to a partnership or a disregarded entity, depending upon the ownership of the LLC at the time they decided to shift back. Interesting case does tell us about this special 60-month rule and how the IRS views the initial election rule. Well, this has been this week, the current federal tax developments. Want to let you know about a couple of things that are of use for you. Number one, please consider signing up to receive emailed articles as updates are posted to our website during the week. You can find that at our website. There'll be a little mailing list click at the top, or you can go to www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com/mailing-list, and you'll find a sign-up form there. Or you could simply email me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com and tell me you want to be on the list, and I can put you there. We do not sell this list to third parties. We're not going to flood you with solicitations. This was put together merely on request by a reader who would like to have had a way to find out when things are posted. So if you want to know that, go ahead, sign up there. You'll get your emails. And as I say, we're not going to go ahead and move that on to third parties. Consider also finding the updates daily. If you don't want the email, you can still go daily to currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com as we post new articles during the week, find out what we've done. You'll also find their articles describing these and more developments for the last week that are there on that blog, and a PDF with articles in detail for all the items we discussed in today's session. Be sure to check your State Society CPA's website for all the full-day courses we're presenting as part of Nichols Patrick and those being presented by the other providers that your State Society is working with for continuing education. You can send, if you have any questions or comments, questions on tax matters, comments on the podcast, you can send those to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com or follow me on Twitter at, my name there is just simply edzollers. And you can follow me and I'll post there. What I post there generally is whenever we have a new article come up. So if you just want to know that way when articles come up, you can follow us there. And be sure to join us next week when we'll take a look at more developments that have happened in the area of federal taxes.